PD Pods present the PD Podscast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to episode 24 of the PD Podscast, hosted by myself, Pranay Budev. I'd like to continue to thank all of our listeners and guests for their time in supporting these podcasts. We've had over 11,000 downloads as we approach the end of our second year. It was also an awesome experience to meet so many of you listeners live in person for the first time face-to-face at the BOA meeting up in Aberdeen last month. And I hope that you continue to support us by downloading the podcast, subscribing to it, and sharing it on social media, including Twitter. Of course, we can always be found at PD Pods. Now, all of our guests that we speak to have something in unique and particular about them that we really want to gauge and learn about their careers, but none more so than the one I sit with today. Mr. Martin Gargan is a consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon based in Bristol. He spent time as the chair at Sick Kids Hospital in Toronto and currently serves as a clinical chair for women's and children's at the University Hospital Bristol Group. He's been clinical director, training program director in the Southwest Deanery, chairman of the BOA Medical Legal Committee, and even chief examiner of the FRCS. He's truly done it all, and I really look forward to learning about his career and how he has managed to balance such a phenomenal professional life with maintaining a personal balance with his family. Mr. Gargan, thank you so much for joining me.
Anna, thank you very much indeed. I'm very grateful and pathetically grateful to be invited in such august company.
Well, it's been awesome because I've known you for a number of years. We used to meet yearly at the RSM Trauma Symposium, and every year you used to give a great talk, and I think you probably continue to do some of that even now. So, you know, you've supported me from very, very early on in my own clinical career, I think even as an SHO. So it's my pleasure to sit with you today and learn really how you've managed to navigate your life really up until now. Take us right back to the beginning. Tell us a bit about your childhood, where you grew up, your family structure, and really what led you into a career in medicine to begin with.
So thanks, Brian. So rather curiously, it's been a sort of a following my nose largely. I was born to up in York. My father was a policeman. My mother was a teacher. We were a Catholic family, so we had lots of children. My mum and dad gave the world boys and weren't very happy with us. So we adopted my sister. Not that's particularly, she's absolutely fabulous. I don't think of anything other than that. So I was the second of six children. We all went to the local Catholic primary school. They had in York in those days, rightly or wrongly, a thing called the 11 plus. And I managed to, trick the examiners, not for the last time, at the age of 10 and a half. And they sent me to a school called St. Peter's. I got what's called a city scholarship. And nowadays that would be considered elite and happy. But rather curiously, I ended up at a school where it was the cool guys opted in and worked hard, and sport was very much on the agenda, and I loved school. I thought it was absolutely fabulous, and I was exposed to all sorts of things. I did classics, Latin and Greek, and a wide spectrum of things for GCSE, and then we had a careers master who got things completely wrong. He told me I should lecture in history, which might have been quite good actually, but I sort of got into, I did quite well in my GCSEs, or O-levels as they were called then, and then I at sixth form I made the monumental step of doing what all my mates did, because I wanted to be in the same class as them. So I did maths, chemistry and physics, and further maths. And by the end of that, I thought I wasn't very good at maths, but it turned out two of the guys in my class were geniuses. Alan Heavens, his father's professor, went to Cambridge, did no work at all, got a top first, was enrolled for a PhD, did no work for 3 years, got a congratulatory PhD, and he's now professor of maths in Pera, and was just terribly clever. And it's actually terribly important through life knowing who you're comparing yourself to. Right, a good bit of advice from his girlfriend, who was a year ahead of us. she'd gone to Oxford, and she was in Lady Margaret Hall, and she said to me she'd been to a toga party in a college called Teddy Hall. And she said she'd noticed that all the blokes there were just like me. And she gave me my first bit of solid advice. I applied to Teddy Hall, and I got in, and I found that that was my tribe. And, you know, I still got my best mates from Teddy Hall even now. And I went to Oxford and once again had a fabulous time. I didn't think preclinical medicine particularly suited me. And so I failed two or three, you know, exams, which, and it said in the varsity rugby program that I had a half blue in examination retakes, which I took to be a badge of honor in some ways, but I eventually managed to get through finals. And therefore I relied on serendipity. And I remember as finally a medical student, I was in the emergency department of the John Radcliffe Hospital. And there was a what would be now called a trauma call, which basically meant someone, in those days, the ambulance man arrived, we've got a sick person here. And a dustbin man was wheeled in on a trolley and he'd been run over by his own dust cart. He still had his orange fatigues on and he was about to die. And he'd been run over and he had a complete sort of compartment syndrome across his abdomen. You know, he had an acute compartment syndrome, and the anaesthetist couldn't bag him, couldn't intubate him, couldn't ventilate him. And a senior registrar called Ian Loudon dashed into the room and said, this man needs an escharotomy. And everyone said, what's that? He got out this huge blade. He made six bold strokes, three on the front, flipped the man over, three on the back, all the muscles from the abdomen wall, thoracoabdominal wall, bulged out, just like a balloon inflating. The anaesthetist, Robert Fraser, said, oh, that's all right, I can intubate him now. Ian Loudon went back to his clinic, and the chap was in hospital for about 3 or 4 weeks with skin grafts and everything, but he saved his life. And I thought to myself, that could well be my tribe. And Ian Loudon was my first great hero, actually. He was just, and I got on to, I qualified, I did house jobs, and I did lots and lots of surgery. You know, before my fellowship, I did 12 kidney transplants, you know, 20 odd hip replacements, a dozen total hips. I did hip fractures, hernias, appendixes, vascular access for a renal transplant job. And it took me 4 years. So I qualified in 84, got my fellowship in 88. And if you look at the pandemic, my eldest daughter has, she's just a CT2 now at St. George's, but she's got her fellowship already as a CT2. You know, she pointed out 3 years before me, but the difference is she's done no surgery, but she's very good at tests. But she got a first in anatomy at Leeds, and I'm sure she will be good. But, you know, the exams are slightly different now. And so I found my tribe. And I went through, and I subsequently got on the Oxford rotation, and I worked for Ian Loudon at Swindon. And he remains a hero. One of my favourite Ian Loudon stories, in fact, is I in the old days, we did lots and lots of surgery. So in my first 18 months on the trauma service in Oxford, and it was the old days, the accident department was run by the trauma team, by the orthopaedic team. There wasn't such a thing in Oxford as an ED consultant. There was a major side run by the physician take and the geriatric take, and the minor side, the fracture side, was run by the orthopaedics. And I was a registrar for 18 months, and for that time I worked with Simon Greg Smith, who's in Bath, and Greg Iddings in Bath as well. And between us, we did every minute of the 6 month slots. You know, there was no, you know, your holidays, there was no cross cover, anything like that. So one of us would be operating virtually all day at all times. So I would, in each of my first 6 months there in a row, I did 700 cases. So you do a huge amount of operating. You were largely taught by the senior registrars. My senior registrar is Malcolm Smith, another great mentor of mine. He's the chief in Boston now, in Massachusetts. But you can take the man out of Sunderland, but you can't take Sunderland out of the man. And he's still we correspond about football results and things like that with Fergal and Pete Janudis, all the other trauma boys, James Hunter, Chris Moran. There's a wonderful confederate of my peers who still keep in touch with my Teddy Hall group, my surgical group. And, you know, we were quite well trained, but actually I was trained just as much by an anaesthetic ODP called Don McStocker. Don McStocker had worked in the trauma theatre on night, permanent nights, for years. And he knew every bit of kit, he knew every fixation, and over the years he'd become a pretty decent trauma surgeon. And if you were fixing a fracture on your own during the night, and it wasn't, he didn't like it, he would tut and he said, Mr. Gargan, he said, I wouldn't do that if I were you. And I said, Mr. Loudon, and he was a good surgeon, he wouldn't do that. So you sat back, and then you had to go through this little charade, and you said, ah, Don, what would Mr. Loudon do now? Because he's a good surgeon. And he said, I think he'd do this. And then, of course, you'd do exactly what Don McStocker suggested, and it would work. Yeah. And it was, you know, and it was, but you had to go through his little game. But eventually, you know, once you've done 18 months with him, and you, it was just fun. But Don McStocker was a very lovely man. And actually, my first ever appraisal, this was, appraisal came in rather later than that in response to Shipman. You decided, oh, a man's killing people. We better appraise doctors to stop people killing people. Actually, the person who'd have scored best on his 360 and all that would have been Harold Shipman. But it came back. But I'd been appointed in Bristol, and I'd gone back to do the postgraduate at Oxford. And Mike Benson, one another mentor of mine who will come to in paediatrics, was there to invite me back to speak. And it was, and I still couldn't call him Mike. I started calling him Mr. Benson even after all those years. And there's that hierarchy. It's quite difficult to, you know, break the glass ceiling. But afterwards, two young registrars came up to me and said, I'm just going, you know, we're trainees on the accident service. And we'd just like to say, it's nice to meet you. That's kind of, you know, he says, because whenever we're operating, like Don McStocker says to us, Mr. Gargan, and he was a good surgeon, he wouldn't do that. And I felt it was an appraisal that eventually, having been useless, but done lots of operating, I had the Don McStocker seal of approval, which I took to be an affirmation of acquisition of some skills.
Yeah.
And that was my first ever appraisal. So that was what, so I sort of, I got through to Oxford, and I was looking around and looking for consultant posts and looking for you know, possible fellowships and things like that. And but I didn't know quite what I wanted to do. And but I came across Mike Benson in my training, Michael Kenneth Darcy Benson, and I wanted to be like him. He was a wonderful technical surgeon, but he had one of the greatest skills a doctor could have. You know, if he was seeing a child with their parents, he could make them feel there could be bombs dropping in the car park of the Nuffield Orthopaedic Centre, and he would not deflect or defer. His only interest was in the child and that child's problem. And patients and parents loved him, and it was great. And my fellowship, and I told him when I said I was thinking of doing PEDS, he said, well, you must do a fellowship. And I said, well, and they were sort of coming in those days. They weren't, you know, quite de rigueur. He said, well, where should I go? He said, you should go see John in London. And I said, John who? He said, go see John Fixum. So he said, how do we sort that out? So he picked up the phone and he said to John Fixum, I'm sending Martin Gargan down to you, fit him in. And nowadays, I see guys sending off CVs and they're getting visas, they're doing something. Mine was all done on a phone call. And I love John Fixon. It was a fabulous, he was the master surgeon. He was nowhere near as good a communicator as Michael Benson was. But he was a fabulous surgeon, a terribly nice man. But I worked out he was just a bit shy. But he was fabulous to me. And when I got my consultant post, I used to write to John saying, and to Mike Benson saying, what do I think of these cases? And they'd write back to me. And then John Fixon used to write a handwritten letter, hand annotated with references. And I realized then, now I get the same request from Gurinder Bailey writes to me from India. And it's a great joy to, you know, carry on that training process. It never stops. And I was speaking to the guys I was examining today before the exam next week. Teaching the next generation is the greatest joy that you can have.
And we're going to get on to sort of your role as a trainer, definitely as part of all this. For those who don't know, John Fixon was at Great Ormond Street, wasn't
Correct.
He? So how was your time at Great Ormond Street? What did you learn from him that you felt you may have not learned from being elsewhere?
Well, I learned a couple of things. And I learned one thing that in those days, in the early 90s, there wasn't such freedom of information and communication as there is now. And whenever I'd go back to Oxford, Mike Benson would be incredibly curious as to what John Fixon was doing with these things. And John Fixon would be incredibly curious as to what Mike Benson did with this. Because there wasn't, you know, nowadays information is exchanged, you know, in real time virtually. So whatever they said, they were still operating in a little bit of a vacuum, a little bit of a silo, and were curious. And I learned one thing very importantly then, that most of the information I was going to get after I became a consultant wouldn't come horizontally, it wouldn't come vertically, it would become inferiorly. And whenever I have new registrars starting with me, the first thing asked of me is, what are you going to teach me in the next 6 months? Not what am I going to teach you? There's a principle of being fossilized in your year of appointment as a consultant, and you must never forget that. You know, things have changed so much. I learned that GOS has a cachet that is, if you look at the world of children's hospitals, you know, planet Earth, you look over there and there are really five hospitals on the horizon. You know, there's Toronto Sick Kids, CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. There is Great Ormond Street. There's Texas Wright, Dallas, and then there's Royal Melbourne. They are, you know, the sort of the big five. And so I took the view that if you're going to work in paediatric orthopaedics in this country, you do need the Great Ormond Street T-shirt. And I loved it. You know, it was we'd had our first child, and I was, I arrived in Great Ormond Street on my first morning. And the first night, I was operating with the urologist doing a bladder extrophy. The child had been born into a family in the British Army on the Rhine 2 hours before I set off for my first shift at Great Ormond Street. We were living, so I used to get up at 5:30. I was in the car. I had the Mark I Golf GTI, which was the junior doctor's car, and with the VW badge stolen by the Beastie Boys from the front. And as long as I left home by 5:45, I used to be in the car park at the Mecklenburg Centre by Great Russell Tube by 6:45. Took an hour at that time. If I left at 6 o'clock or after, I'd be there at 8 o'clock. If I left at 6:10, I'd be there at 9 o'clock. The traffic used to build exponentially. If I was there at 6:45, I had to go to my room in GOS. I used to have a 10-minute power nap. I'd get up, have a little shower, shave, and I'd be the freshest person on the ward at 7:30 in the morning. Worked brilliantly. Same token, on the way home, sometimes you did get stuck outside Euston Station, going from one end to the other in 3 hours when the Westway was spot. But Great Ormond Street has a, you know, just a wonderful cachet. Orthopaedics was a little quiet in terms of it had John, and there was Rob Hill was there. They'd lost George Roy Roberts and John Penn, you know, John Fixon always used to refer to him as my old Chief George. And he had that same, you know, knew where he was in the circle of life. But we did wonderful things because the adjacencies brought in marvellous things that you'd never see. And I met, you know, Paul Smith was the congenital hand surgeon. And that was, you know, he was fabulous. I used to go and watch the congenital hands and I was almost, you know, persuaded to do that. But I knew when I saw John Fixon and Mike Benson doing Hips that that was going to be, you know, what I liked. And, you know, it was just great. Watching John Fixon doing a Pemberton osteotomy without an image intensifier and just looking at it, and he just knew where it was. His visuospatial skills were fabulous. And so GOS was great. You know, I loved it.
I also believe you went out to Detroit in Michigan to do a trauma fellowship.
So that was a research fellowship, in fact. And that was, I'd go back one stage. When I'd moved down to Bristol the first time, I got my a primary. And in those days, you needed a year of general surgery for fellowship. And so I needed a standalone surgical job, and I got one working with a man called Barry Pentlow, who was another, you know, great influence on me. In fact, Barry's now in his sort of towards his late 70s. I've got to pick him up on Saturday at 2 o'clock, drive him to watch Bristol Bears against Worcester Warriors, and drive him home again afterwards. Because in the scheme of life, my relationship with him won't change. But Barry was very kind to me. He looked after me, took me through a lot of surgery. But then I got my fellowship, and then I applied for the registrar job in Bristol, and I wasn't shortlisted. And I thought, hang on a minute, I'm a jolly good chap. I've got a rugby blue. I've kept my nose clean here, but I hadn't been shortlisted. And I thought, what's going on? And so I went to see a chap called Gordon Bannister. He said, show me your CV. And I showed him my CV. He said, well, all you've done is play rugby. You've done no research. And I said, well, Gordon, in fairness, I've never had an original idea in my life. He said, well, here's your first one. He said, all these people had whiplash injuries in the early 1980s reported by Norris and Watt, Steve Norris in Bristol. They're supposed to be better. Why don't you go see if they are? And so I thought, well, that's interesting. So I went and I found all these people, and I did what was subsequently called Whiplash One. And all these people weren't better. In fact, some of them were worse. And so I did this research paper with Gordon, won the prize, the Southwest Orthopaedic Prize, and was a sort of a start of a research program. And, you know, I went down to Swindon and set up my own research clinic there. I went back to Oxford, and there was this thing advertised, the Royal College of Surgeons General Motors Trauma Fellowship. And I applied for that and got it. And I went to Detroit for 2 months, it sort of May and June of 93. And I had a fabulous time, and I learned, you know, so the General Motors, if they want to do something, they throw money at it. And I was put in a thing with Dave Viano, the chief scientist, a lab where I saw cameras that could take, you know, 50 pictures a second. The technology in the motor industry was quite extraordinary. And so I set up some high G sled testing, simulated rear end collisions, and we wrote a couple of papers from that. But I learned a lot about industry's relationship with medicine, a lot about science and just the construction of arguments. Lovely. Great times. That's incredible. Watch the Detroit Tigers play baseball, It seemed the nicest place in the world. When I came back, one of my friends said, do you know why you're in Detroit? There were 35 murders within about 2 miles of where I'd been. I didn't feel a thing. Extraordinary.
That's crazy. Tell me about your appointment. You were appointed in Bristol in 1994. How did that all come about? And how did you sort of develop your clinical practice and expertise in the area? Because there wasn't many people, I take it, doing sort of big hip dysplasia cases, or especially periastabular osteotomies, which is something you brought to the region, from what I know.
Yeah, no, so it's interesting. So I Mrs. Gargan, who was from born in Wimbledon, but lived in Sutton in Surrey, and she was a Bristol medic. She came back to GP in Oxford. We had our first child in 94, and our second one in Bristol in 95. And I said, where are we going to go for consultant posts? And I said, there's a job in Leeds and there's a job in Nottingham. And then she drew a line across England just north of Oxford, a horizontal line, and said, anywhere below there, Gargs. So that was a very clear mandate to go south. And of course, Ian Learmonth rang me one day and said, you know, we're looking for a senior lecturer here. Gordon Bannister's recommended you. And I said to Jane, you know, what about Bristol? And of course, we said, so I came for, shortlisted, and I came for interview, and all went well, and I was appointed. The condition of my appointment was that I passed the FRCS Oath exam, which was the following week. Now, I know I've been chatting to four guys today who are doing the exam next week in their final, you know, Gargan finishing school of teaching and training, and they're under quite a lot of stress. But if you imagine, it really was an exit exam in those days. And my consultant appointment relied on me passing the exam, the FRCS Oath. And I was the first year of people that had to do it. Before that, it was optional. But my year, Simon Gray Smith, Roger Gundle, you know, Ronan Tracy in Birmingham, we were the first guys, James Hunter, who had to do it. And it was a proper exit exam, as opposed to now it's rebadged as a, you know, an exam just to take you into the final stage of training. And I guess my my USP, you know, my unique selling point wasn't particularly unique, but I was wanted to do paediatric orthopedics. Peter Witherow had a single-handed practice. He did spines as well. And I've just completed his obituary. He died early last year. He was the most fabulous man, was a real polymath, considered, and I commend you to his obituary in PLAS Lives and the JTO next month. And he was a single-handed surgeon, and the greatest testimony to him is that he can, you know, he's been replaced by essentially 10 people. And if I had one criticism of Mike Benson and John Fixon, they had a rather a nihilistic attitude to cerebral palsy. Whereas Peter Witherow was ahead of his time, really, and he developed a number of things. The first skeletal dysplasia database is down here. He really worked with a physiotherapist called Jane Pyman to work on, you know, the multi-level surgery. And I've talked about surgeons who influenced me. There was a patient who influenced me. There's a chap called Matthew Roderick. I'm sure he won't mind me mentioning his name because he knows I've done it in the past. And I was doing the clinic at Hackney Hospital, which isn't there anymore. It was a funny old place. And Alistair Roderick had CP, and he had very bad feet, and he had crouched gait, etc. But he had very high IQ, and he was a clever chap. And I saw him in Hackney when I was a fellow at GOS, and I sent him off for some new orthotic shoes. And that was fine. Anyway, then he decanted to Bristol and lived in the Chew Valley. His father moved. And for some strange reason, he came back to see me again when he was 14 and a half. 13 and a half, 14 and a half, by which time I started to work with Peter's multi-level program. And I said, oh, Alistair, I think what we should do here is correct your feet. We should rotate your femora out so your knees point straight, which would point your feet out. Therefore, we need to rotate your tibias back in. But before we do that, you need subtalar arthrodesis to make your foot shaped and flat on the ground. And then when we've done that, we wait 6 weeks, then we do fractional lengthening of all your muscles, psoas, hamstrings, adductors, rectus transfers, and then you'll be much better off. And he looked at me and said, Mr. Gunn, can I point out the obvious discrepancy here? But a year and a half ago, you were saying to me, why don't I get you a pair of orthotic shoes? Now you're advising, 10 hours of surgery, 6 weeks of inpatient rehab. Have you been on the road to Damascus? And so he's... His comment was very curious, we did his surgery, and he did fabulously well, and he went to Exeter University. He kept in touch for some time, and he was, you know, he did say after about 3 weeks, he said, what on earth have I let you do? Because people always do that when they're in the middle of that rehab phase. But the multi-level surgery, and we've reported that, and it's been published in the last year, and it really does work. And rather funnily, it's I first started when SDR had been done, you know, a decade before and had been stopped because it was just making people weak and was indiscriminate and had a very bad reputation because the S wasn't selective enough. And now that's come back and it's been properly staged, managed by orthopedic surgeons rather than neurosurgeons. And that in concert with a multi-level program is giving these children the best chance of improving their walking. And it's really great to see. But, you know, beware the zealots, but beware the people who are afraid of taking chances in some ways. But, you know, with good backup and good data and good monitoring of your results. And so I started down Bristol in 94, I was doing full adult trauma. I loved my trauma, and my elective practice was hips. And I thought, I said to, because I'd worked with Peter Warlock and Keith Willis in Oxford, and I loved doing the pelvic metatarsal work. And I thought, well, I could do pelvic metatarsal practice here. So I rang Tony Ward, who was the local pelvic and acetabular surgeon, who'd been was a year older than me. And I said, Tony, I'm very keen to do the pelvic acetabular work with you. He said, oh, no, there's only enough work for one. So I thought, oh, that's a bit of a shame. I like working around the pelvis. So I went to do the GAMS course with David Reynolds at Stanmore. I went to the hip course there. I listened to David Reynolds talk, and I thought, oh, that's like the sort of thing I should be doing. So I got on the train, I went down with David Reynolds, and I used to go down and watch him and then assist him, and then he let me do them. Then I got my equipment set up here. And so I did my first, within about a year of appointing, and I was starting to do them here. And David Reynolds was very kind. He sort of sent his practice up to me. Hugh Abthorpe started doing them down in Kent, and John O'Hara did a slightly different version, his cogwheel thing in Birmingham. But it was a fabulous practice to have and to take over. And it worked, and we did the pre-donation. We had, we looked at various other parameters, and we've, written it up. And it really works, hip dysplasia, it works. So it was a good operation. Then I'd done about 20, I think. And Tony Ward rang me, says, Marty, I'm snowed under with pelvic and acetabular work. Can you help? And I said, well, sorry, Tony, I'm afraid I'm snowed under with acetabular reconstruction. You'll have to appoint somebody else. So he appointed Tim Jesser, and then it all sort of works, really.
It's incredible to hear how, as you sort of said, even in your first year as a consultant, your practice develops as you sort of go through your career, and then opportunities arise to learn something and develop a service in the area you're in. I mean, I'm out in Essex at the moment, and there wasn't much of a service, and now we've developed a neuromuscular service, and we're doing semels and femoral osteotomies, and we have links with other hospitals that do hip preservation work. It's really a true joy to sort of bring in, and you feel almost accomplished yourself as a surgeon in those stages where you continuing to learn despite being the consultant, who's running the service. Let's talk about your role as a trainer, because one thing you are most definitely known as is by far an absolutely incredible trainer. You were training program director of the Southwest Deanery from 2002 to 2008. And one, I'm sure, very proud statistic you have is you had a 100% pass rate for your trainees passing the FRCS, which was absolutely brilliant. You've obviously, you're a runner-up of the BOTA 2008 Trainer of the Year. Tell me, what do you feel makes a good trainer? I mean, it's something you're still obviously involved with now, as you mentioned earlier, with your sort of the Gargan Finishing School, as you called it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to be committed to it. And actually, what helps you being a good trainer is having been in receipt and being grateful of great training. And I say, I still carry around, the people who trained me, and I'm terribly grateful. And so I moved down to Bristol. I enjoyed teaching the medical students. I was voted trainer of the year by the teacher of the year by the medical students in Bristol, having arrived pretty soon. But the thing I did in Bristol, and I think the thing of which I'm probably most proud, is I've changed the culture of training down here. And I definitely established in the old days the training attachments were predicated by the cover requirements of the consultant. And, you know, the more senior consultants could have the more senior trainees so that they could do something else. And I actually said, what we should do here is change this. So the trainees are attached to the places where they will get the training they require. And it's terribly simple, seems, you know, so, but it was quite a bit of resistance. And so what I did was I got everybody in the room on the Friday afternoon, a year in advance. I put all the jobs on a whiteboard. It was the best attended postgraduate session of the year. All the jobs, and then people were picked their job for the next 6 months or a year after in order. And they were prioritized in the people coming up to the exam. So generally the fourth year's got first dibs. And after that, then the most senior trainees who were looking for consultant posts, they had the next choice because they needed certain things for consultant applications. And then there was a strict order of people in terms of appointment. And actually, we had it eventually down to when we appointed people on a day, when in the old days you'd appoint 4 or 5 people in a day, the order they were appointed was the order they chose. And the first day, it was quite instructive. I had at least 3 what you might consider senior consultants who didn't match. In the old days, you had all the, you know, type 1 trainees, and then the gaps were filled up by SHO3s or LATs or LASSes, as they were known, locum accredited for training, locum accredited for services. And so there'd be gaps available. And I had 3, you know, frantic phone calls on the following Monday morning when the list was published saying, I see I haven't got a trainee for the next 6 months. And I said, you're quite right. He said, why on earth is that? I said, because no one wants to work for you. He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, I've decided that trainees are going to be allocated on the basis of the training they'll receive, not, you know, and I was a bit unpopular for a while, actually, with some of the senior consultants, but actually it worked. You know, suddenly people who hadn't bothered to train were suddenly upping their game, and it benefited everybody. And it was, you know, it was a fabulous thing. And you know, we had, and I wouldn't let trainees go to the exam unless they knew they were going to pass it, because, you know, it was bad for business. And it was, and we instituted a mock exam at Christmas that everyone had to do. And you know, it was, some people didn't like it, but it was very good to see who could do the exam and who couldn't. You know, we had great trainees, and we still do. And it's still a great place to work.
Yeah, lots of your colleagues, previous trainees that I've spoken to have spoken so highly of the training system down in Bristol. And obviously, I completely commend what you did, which is actually give them the choice of who they want to be trained by, because that made consultants up their game to train people better. And really levels of playing field. Everyone's a winner in that situation. Tell me, how did you end up becoming chief examiner of the FRCS, and how was that? And how have you felt the test itself has changed over the past 10 years or so, for better or for worse?
So the exam has changed because in the old days, you could ask what you liked. You know, there was that great thing that Charles Galasco, I was a big fan of Charles, he examined me, his settling question. Exam theory came along. There was that educationalist, David Pitts, who used to come and teach people how to examine, how to lecture. And he had some really good ideas. Charles Galasco's settling question was, tell me about the embryology of the notochord. Well, that could stimulate your adrenal medulla like a charging rhinoceros. And so the exam became a little bit more formulaic, and you had to have a settling question, then a default question. And then if the candidate got that right, then you could go and explore what's called higher order thinking and see whether, you know, you see the default, there's a settling question. The default was whether you were a 5 or a 6, and the 6 is a pass, the 5 is a fail. If you got the default question wrong, then you were in a remedial exam, see if you knew enough to pass. If you got the default right, then you'd be explored for the next few minutes as to whether you were a 7 or even an 8. Even though it was a pass-fail exam, there was still a prize for it, which seems a little bit counterintuitive, but that's the way it was, and it's not unreasonable. It was fabulous fun, and lots of people wanted to examine. And as I say, you know, I never failed anybody in the exam. I was present when people insisted on failing themselves. And when I teach the guys now, the most important thing is to, you know, understand the question, think, why am I being asked this? What is the examiner looking for? And what I mustn't do is, if I don't want to talk about something, don't give them any information. If something's obvious, don't mention something else unless I really want to talk about it. And exam technique is quite important, but doing the work is even far more important. Nowadays, I think when everybody being asked the same question by the same group of examiners, it doesn't allow quite the same breadth of experience, but I can see why we have to do that. It was not my favourite. I think it's good, you know, I've encouraged my colleagues, and, you know, now we're 8 or 9 in Bristol, you know, we have a sort of a plan for people coming through career progression. When you start, you pick up governance and audit to start with, and then you move on to be, you know, assigned educational supervisor. You might do a little bit of, if you're doing, you've got a research portfolio, then you're encouraged to do that. If you're more interested in management, you'd be encouraged to go and do that. But we've had a lot of my time here, the training program director has been from Bristol Children's Hospital. And it's always, he is in charge of the trainees is relatively influential. And then there's, becoming an examiner or going to national committees and things like that. We like to have people on BOSCOS, we like to have people on BOA, because it's good for business, it's good for reputation, it's good to attract, it's to keep the circle of life going. But we think about it. It doesn't happen by chance. You know, there's a system that works.
Something I was very interested to learn about you was you sat on the BOA Medical Legal Committee and even served as chairman for that. And you also represented BOA on CORES, which is a confidential reporting system for surgery. Now, I'll be honest, I had no idea that this even existed. So tell me, you know, what does the BOA Medical Legal Committee do? How does it support BOA members? And what did you learn actually serving on that committee and acting as chairman for it?
So it was interesting. So I was encouraged to look at that. And I was interested in the way that, you know, my profession was presented nationally. And I felt being on the BOA committee, I stood for council, and I was on that for a time. And I joined the Medical Legal Committee and chaired that. And I was interested in the legal process, and I've been fascinated, you know, by the law. And I had a big medical legal practice. I didn't really ever do private practice. And I felt that children, there wasn't a lot of private practice. And I sort of had a slightly socialistic view. My mother would have been proud of that children, you know, I mean, I think we're quite lucky in the UK that we don't have to do things predicated on any financial remuneration that we might get. It's a massive, medicine and money don't mix. But if you're, providing a report for my learned friend, I found it was interesting, but it also was, a remunerative way to spend my time. And I felt if I had some influence on how it ran nationally, then that would be helpful. So the Medical Legal Committee, it looked at changes in law, it looked at various other things. There were also some, you know, occasional disputes between people that needed a bit of refereeing. There was a very famous occasion where a well-known cricket commentator's hip replacement dislocated, and it was revised again by a different surgeon 2 days later. It was a curious old thing, and it was nice to point out no one would come out of it well, and it certainly wasn't the cricket commentator's fault, and it was, you know, it was settled amicably on that. But it was making orthopaedic surgeons behave well is always just requires a little bit of fine tuning from time to time. But most of our colleagues are absolutely, you know, top professionals and good folk. But the CORES thing was interesting. And the CORES thing is essentially learning from the aviation industry. You know, if two planes come within 2 feet of each other anywhere, then that is that's a near thing to hundreds of people dying. And if that happens, there's an immediate investigation. And the principle was, in medicine, as long as nothing bad happened, nothing happened. And so there was a thing where it started to report things where things almost bad happened, and can we interrogate that and see what lessons could be learned so it prevented it? And the career still goes on, in fact. I'm not quite sure how effective it's been, in fact, because generally speaking, in terms of for the best will in the world, it's to do with money. You know, if you're saving, 400 lives in one go, there's much more interest in it from people than if you might be saving, a piece of morbidity or mortality, which is difficult to justify if you're treating a population. And that's the worry about complications. You know, you can give your complication rate in percentage, but if you're the patient who has it, it's 100% for you. And you must never forget that. And, I emphasize that on a regular basis, 100% for the patient. So it was co-res. I found it interesting. It was an interesting process. I'm not quite sure it was quite the model to take for surgery, where we're dealing with individuals as opposed to risking huge populations. But it was of interest.
Now let's move to 2014, where you were appointed as the Harold and Bernice Graves Chair, essentially the chief of orthopedic division at SickKids in Toronto, one of the big five, as you mentioned earlier. What made you go out to Canada in the first place?
Well, they asked me. So it was a sort of a funny old thing. Over there, they have two eponymous lectures a year. They have the Rang lecture, visiting professorship, in the May, and the Salter in the October. And I was invited out to be the Rang lecturer, Rang professor, in 2013. And I went over there, you stayed for, Jane was invited as well, but couldn't go for a number of reasons. We had a child doing GCSEs, I think. And I went over and I gave a talk, did some teaching, and I played a couple of rounds of golf with John Wedge, who's another great hero of mine. John Wedge, absolutely marvellous. And Jim Wright was the chief of surgery. And I, had a wonderful 3 or 4 days, taught lots, met lots of folks. And I thought Toronto was fabulous. And I came back, and Ben Allman was the chief there. And he just was going off to do the chief job at Duke. Jane picked me up at Heathrow, and I said, Jane, Ben Allman is going, and the chief job's going to be up in Toronto, and I'm just wondering quite why they've invited me to be the Rang professor. Anyway, and then about 6 weeks later, Jim Wright rang me and said, Martin, he said, I wonder if I could just send you an application to have a look at. It's the chief's job, and I wonder if you might be interested in having a chat about it. So, we've had to advertise it in Canada because all Canadian jobs have to be advertised to Canadians first. But he said, we haven't attracted what we feel is a satisfactory field, and therefore we can invoke the thing called the LMA, the Labour Market Advantage. And I said, you'll send me a Jim and I'll have a look. And I said, there is one thing, Jim. I said, if I have to learn the Krebs tricarboxylic acid cycle again, then it's a complete no-no. But in fact, even if you go to America, and if they want you, you can sidestep the CEMELS exams and what have you. But one thing led to another. I was invited over. They have a search committee, and I was invited over for 3 days of interviews, and they offered me the job. And then I went back with Jane and the girls at Easter to see if we wanted the job. And, I'd done 30 years in the National Health Service to the day I left. I felt it was, an opportunity to go and do something different. So, we went, and, we had a fabulous time. I had you know, did lots of operating. I did lots of teaching, training, but I did lots of other, you know, stuff as well. On the administrative side, I was sent on the Rotman management course, and I really learned how big organizations work. They're complicated, but there are certain things that are standard. And actually, there are some things that Canada's absolutely brilliant. They're better than we do. And there are some things that we do much better than them. Quite a lot of stuff we do quite a similar way. But one thing that Canadians have maintained is respect for doctors. You know, doctors have a cachet in Sick Kids Hospital. I work in a hospital here where my local BBC man, Matthew Hill, I hope you're listening, Matthew, his job is to say bad things about Bristol Royal Hospital for Children. If he worked in Toronto, he'd be lynched. You can't say bad things about the Sick Kids Hospital unless you say good things first. And there's lots of good things going on here, but in this country, it's not quite so newsworthy. But the Children's Hospital in Toronto is a source of you know, regional and national and international pride. And I think that is something that's possibly suffering for our profession in this country. You know, some groups haven't had a good pandemic, in my view. Some groups had a fabulous pandemic. But actually, if you still look, if you're looking at job creation, the most difficult thing to get into this in the country still is medicine. So something's okay. And that's, you know, reassuring. So we went, we had absolute ball. We did lots of traveling. I'd be invited to give rounds at Columbia in New York and Boston at Harvard and Chicago. I go as a guest of the BOA in Vancouver. We traveled around North America, which was fun. Went to Mexico a couple of times. Went to the Super Bowl in Minneapolis. I used to go watch all the sport. I used to watch Tom Brady throw a football at, and went to Fenway Park to watch the Red Sox. And it was just spectacular. Rather funnily, I mean, I live in a, you know, relatively large Victorian house in Bristol. Over in Toronto, I lived in a two-bedroom apartment with a den, with a magnificent view on the 49th floor of a building where the first language was Mandarin. But it was, we loved it. You know, the Chinese were terribly good neighbors. They were all math students from the university whose parents had bought them a flat. But they were good neighbors. They made no noise at all. And, you know, we could walk to 100 restaurants within 10 minutes. You know, and we lived downtown and we really enjoyed it. The lifestyle was good and it was fun.
We've had quite a few of your colleagues from Sick Kids as guests on this podcast. We had Benina Ryan, we've had Simon Kelly, we have had Jim Wright and Andy Howard. So we've had a huge, quite a large Sick Kids component. So, you know, to hear from the chief himself, who was there for a period of time, is great. What made you come back to Bristol then from Canada? It seemed like it was a phenomenal job with huge responsibility and lots of gravitas, as you sort of say.
Oh, no, I work with Uni and Simon, and I'm still in touch with them. And Andrew Howard, who's taken over as the chief now, and good luck to him. He's a splendid man. I if I'd have stayed for another term, I would have been Canadian and stayed there. But I had an unhappy child who wanted to come back. And if you have more than one, you can't do one thing different from one child you do with the others. So when I came over, my eldest was at med school. My second did a gap year, then went off to med school in Cambridge. My third one came over, taking a 13-year-old girl away from a friendship group. That was the unknown that I hadn't quite computed. And she became rather cross. She's fabulous now. She's at med school in Leeds, but she wanted to come back. And I missed, you know, I missed the surgery, which was great, and I missed the fellows who were fabulous. My colleagues were great. The Canadians, how do you get 100 Canadians out of a swimming pool?
No idea.
You say, can you leave the swimming pool, please? So they're a very law-abiding people, and they don't do irony particularly well. Except there was the administrative lady, Julianne Gordon, who remains a friend of mine. She was a very Anglophile who got all the English gangs, and she's been able to visit. She's fabulous. But I missed Fergal, and I missed, you know, my friends. And there'd been a bit of unhappiness in Bristol where the hospitals had merged into a centralised or specialised paeds, and they'd had a sort of a void of a surgical leader, and it wasn't something that could easily be done. And it just turned out that timing was quite good. Someone who was known, but who'd been away, hadn't sort of observed the unhappy intertwining. And there was a job there, and I came back to my friend, Mr. Monsell, and his gang, and it's worked pretty well.
And that brings us very beautifully on to your current role as a sort of clinical chair for the Women and Children's Division in that new sort of system, as you mentioned. And I guess, as you sort of said, you learnt about how big institutions work from your time out in Canada and the sort of course you did. Tell me, what does your current role entail? Because it's quite a large spectrum, and as you sort of covers women's and children, it's not just paediatric orthopaedics.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Just in my mailbag just this week, you know, we've had to make a choice between a child with a hypoplastic heart or a living donor transplant because of the lack of PQ beds, pediatric intensive care unit. So I'm often refereeing that, and I'm refereeing with colleagues who are keen advocates for their own patients, and I'm comparing an apple with an orange, etc. We've had problems over half term with my staffing in the neonatal intensive care unit, which is absolutely rammed. I've got patients around the region, pediatric patients sitting on adult ITU beds, and there's a complicated divert system, and I need to be mindful of that. I start my day, I go to the intensive care unit, I go to the emergency department and the theatres, and they're my real pinch points. If they're okay, then I'm fine. I deal with some interesting, able but slightly autistic people who don't realise the effect they have on people. And consultants have to remember that there's a significant power gradient. And when a consultant says something to someone who's on a lower pay grade, it has a much greater impact than if they say it to a peer. And some people don't recognise that. But I remind them, and then they're much better people for that. So so managing people's an interesting thing, managing resources and managing budgets, and I have some knowledge of that, and I work closely with the finance officer. I work closely with the divisional director and the head of nursing, because, you know, working together and having a relationship with the management team and the nursing team is people who do their jobs in isolation don't get the best out of the system. So I'm lucky that the nurses in Bristol Children's and the maternity hospital are fabulous, the midwives. But it's been tough, and I've noticed that, you know, I think that endurance is taking its toll on people's psyche, and normally you find that I can tell the usual suspects are going to cause trouble. You know, we're at the stage of the pandemic now where even the unusual suspects, the people who would normally react to stress and crisis by running up their sleeves and working harder, are starting to creak at the seams. So we're not through this at all yet, but it's my job to try and, you know, maintain morale and keep things going. And it's a bit like teamwork on a rugby pitch. You know, leadership as an exemplar, I think, is my style. There's only one true measure of leadership, of course, Pranay, is looking over your shoulder to see how many people are still there. And because no one tells you how you're doing in this job, it's a little lonely. But it is, and it's interesting. The most important thing at 62, I'm the oldest doctor on call, but when I'm speaking to people who are, you know, working out of hours and everything, I can't have them with the gainsay of saying you don't know what it's like anymore. Because I can say, well, I do actually. I was operating last week during the night. But I need to have that ticket to say, you know, as Fergal would say, Fergal would call it Fergal Monsalau. I prefer to Fergal, presumably most people would know who he is. You know, it's called top trumps. It's a game you're all familiar with. But, you know, it's when your top trump is bigger than somebody else's top trump. But it's fun. And I take luncheon with Fergal most days. And he's my sounding board for things, and likewise for him. But it's good to work with your friends. I have fabulous colleagues here, Gareth and Simon Thomas, and, you know, Jim Turner, Jimmy Barnes, two fabulous girls, Dominic Knight, Anna Clark. You know, it's a really, really good team here.
Obviously, this management role is not something that comes naturally to us. We're not really taught how to be great managers during our orthopedic training. Yes, you know, we're encouraged to do a sort of some type of management course, but really doing what you're doing takes experience, wisdom, having been in the system, as you said, sort of still having a ticket. You know, I'm amazed how you and Fergal still are on the on-call road. To most people that have jumped ship a long, long time ago. But what makes you good at being this manager? And what advice would you give to consultants and colleagues who are starting out if they were interested in getting into this type of, you know, role?
So it's interesting. I would start by, do a course. I think they're quite good. There's some quite good management courses. But just go and shadow a manager at some point. Say, you know, what do you do? What do you do and how do you do it? And find out what things they find most interesting by irritating with your clinical colleagues. And you'll soon find out whether you have an aptitude for it or not. And quite often you find that people can see what's wrong early in their consultant career, but they're not old enough, if you like, or grey-haired enough to influence it. And by the time they're grey-haired enough and have enough experience to manage it, they've run out of steam and lost interest. And I suspect Fergal and I are quite different. We haven't run out of steam because, we've been mates and we've got strong peers and we felt it was important to do it. But some people have an aptitude for it and some people don't. And, you know, but there's lots of things you can do once, you know, you can do research, you can do management, you can do, you know, media, you can do, there's a thousand things you can teach and train. It's, you know, there's lots of things that you can expand that comes in that, you know, adds to the, you know, the team and reputational advancement. But just give it a try. It, you know, you'll find that most people, if nothing else, it's like doing research. The principle of doing any research is at least you can read a paper and work out whether it's, you know, it's crucial, it's interesting, it's rubbish, or it's complete rubbish. But in management, you get a little bit of a flavour about what are the important decisions and what are the not so important decisions. Funny, I was at the Trust Board last week and one of the trustees was talking about how we're falling behind on appraisal. And I pointed out respectfully to the chairman. I said, you know, what we've been encouraged to do in the pandemic is see what's worked well. You know, some things like some of the remote consultations we've done, but some things that we haven't missed. And we suspended appraisal for a year. And I said, you know, I'm not so sure that missing appraisal has caused us any great damage because maybe appraisal, we're not doing it right. We're not assessing the right things. I said, unsurprisingly, I said, I have to do appraisal because I don't do it. I can't expect anyone else to do it. But unsurprisingly, my 360 was so glowing. I wanted to know what they were talking about because I'd asked the right people. And I said, I think we should have and this was a man who'd come from industry, one of the trustees, and where it was just a tick box exercise. And some things do need to be interrogated as to exactly what we're doing and why. I find in the health service, the reason we're doing things today is generally speaking, because that's how we did it yesterday. And unless we think about it, we'll do it exactly the same tomorrow because we're doing it like that today. Whereas when you do be able to stand back and you have a little bit more experience, you can say, well, hang on a minute, that's not working. Let's think again. And some people, you know, one of my good friends is Tim O'Brien, who's the president of BAUS, the urologist. And he's a magnificent real-time thinker about things. If anyone wants to watch a good bit of, go watch his address, his inaugural address to the British Association of Urological Surgeons. You can Google it. It's a masterpiece of looking at things and really evaluating what we're doing and wondering if we're right, but giving some suggestions as to how it might improve. Always don't just go with problems, always go with solutions, you're much more likely to make an impact.
Yeah. Well, you know, what you mentioned about you and Vogel still not running out of steam in what you're doing really brings us to sort of end of this conversation, but to talk about how you managed a work-life balance, how what sort of you've done outside of work that's kept you sane. I know your family's very important to you. I mean, you know, three girls, all medics. I think that's a true testament of how good a trainer you actually are. You're able to do it in your own household as well. But how do you relax? And again, you've sort of been at the helm during the pandemic in this role. How would you expect people to maintain their wellness at this stage?
Yeah, well, the pandemic was interesting. So we were very fortunate that Kate was a clinical student at Cambridge, so she came home and isolated here. Rachel was doing her A-levels, and so they were at home together. You know, we fortunately live on the Downs in Bristol, so we had somewhere to walk and exercise. You know, I can't imagine what the pandemic was like when you're living on the top of a, you know, living in Toronto would have been quite troublesome, even on the 49th floor, not being able to go out. And I've, you know, being able to go to work was a savior for me in the pandemic. I get bored pretty easily. And I'm a keen sportsman. I mean, I try and stay fit, and there's no doubt if you're a bit fitter, you feel a bit better. And I swam regularly before the pandemic, that closed down. I've not quite returned to that, just got out of the habit, but I cycle to work and I play golf. I'm a keen golfer. You know, I enjoy my golf. I was single figure handicap when I went to Canada, but the fact the golf course is closed there from October to March and they're all 3 hours out of town is a bit of a difficulty. So I'm now staggering around 14 as a handicap, but I enjoy my golf and that's great fun. And, you know, we live in Bristol, which is a fabulous place to live. You know, we can, there's lots of places to eat. We go watch Bristol, have a season ticket holder for Bristol Bears, which this season hasn't been as good as last season. I'm an avid fan of Leeds United. Again, this season hasn't been as good as last season. I'm a sort of a fan of Spurs from Fergal. So I'm going up to the El Clasico a week on Sunday, Spurs versus Leeds at White Hart Lane. And the children are busy and buzzy, and they quite like to come home. They're both in two in Southwest Thames, and Rachel's in Leeds, so it's not too far away. And we're very lucky. We've got Alfie the Labrador, who requires plenty of exercise, and Jane is keeps everything ticking. The Home Secretary and Chancellor of the Exchequer keeps everything ticking at home beautifully for us all.
Well, it sounds like not only have you had an immense career and continue to do, but you have a beautiful life at home. And, you know, we've covered a huge spectrum of topics in this conversation. I just want to thank you again for all your time that you've given me today. Thank you so, so much.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure. Thanks very much indeed.
And for those who can hear fireworks in the background, that's because it's Diwali today. So happy Diwali to everyone.
Happy Diwali.
This is coming out just in a couple of days' time. And for all of those, you know where to find us online. And we're going to be back next month on the first Sunday of each month. And we'll be going into our third year in 2022. Thank you all for listening. And thank you very, very much.
Privilege and a pleasure.